Time for Sports Lit 101, and Bruce is here with a copy, the latest copy of Athlon.
Yeah, this is spring 21, summer 21. It's always about a year. These kind of periodicals about a year behind. Ron Smith has collected some fabulous poetry. I mean, there's lots of good stuff in it. There's good prose. There's an excerpt from a play. There's some good scholarly articles. But this is maybe one of the best overall poetry editions. And I one of them, the one we're going to start with, is from our friend Don Johnson, friend of the show, book Blue Wing Olive we've talked about, his wonderful poems, including Watauga Drawdown, we've had Don on to talk about. But, you know, what drew me to this is Mark Twain once said that he had seen in 4 and 20 hours in Hartford, Connecticut, 125 different kinds of weather. Now, as we know, New England, because it is on the East Coast, and all the weather patterns, the predominant weather patterns in North America come from the West. They could be Northwest, Due West, Southwest, South by Southwest, they come from the West. So they collide with the ocean, and very often we have very dramatic changes in very short periods of time. Another place that happens is out in places like Montana, where you have the mountains in the western end, and you have the Great Flats after that, and they can be subject to prolonged drought, and if it rains, to tremendous flooding. It's a very, I think the record turnaround in temperature in America is like 110 degrees in 24 hours, and that was 70 degrees to 40 below in Montana.
Wow.
I could be, that those not, don't anyone hold me to those, but it's close. It's some huge thing. So anyway, along the Bighorn River, to stop erosion from terrible flash flooding, they took all these old cars, took the engines out, backed them up, and they used them on the bank. And when the river gets high, the ends of them get underwater, and fish will get in the open trunks and all this kind of stuff. And they call it fishing the drive-in because it looks like you're going past the drive-in. So this is, Don wrote a poem called Fishing the Drive-In, and then a former student of his by the name of, is it Robert Harlow? Robert Harlow wrote Not Fishing the Drive-In for Don Johnson. So we read these two fishing poems. More than 50 cars line the steep bank of the Bighorn on the Crow Reservation, Fort Smith, Montana. Wrecks with tops stove in as if we're all salvage rollovers, back down above the waterline to stem erosion. At high water, their bumpers disappear beneath the surface, sprung trunk lids offering shade and havens to big browns. We cast to as we floating by. Our tiny sparkle duns and blue-winged olives invisible to these old eyes until a splash reveals them 20 feet away. Doesn't happen this pass, so our guide rows back upstream for another go. It's twilight, and I stow the rod to catalog instead the rusted hulls I recognize. A 46 Ford like my grandfather drove. An early 50s Chevy style line, colorless in shadows. The blue and white 56 Victoria, still not fully rusted over. In August 1959, we took one like it to the drive-in in Triangle, Virginia. 8 of us, 2 in the trunk, sweating in the heat, jammed hip to hip, or tucked and rolled upholstery. We watched Gidget, and I became kahuna to them all, unaware that 8 months later at the Kapi'olani Drive-In in Honolulu, I would see Where the Boys Are, jealous that my friends and I could not enjoy Fort Lauderdale's spring break. We had to settle for Kauai, Hanalei's deserted beach, the water slide, the film crew left from South Pacific, the college girls who checked in our first night at the Coral Reef Hotel. I forgot their names, even the first girl I spent the whole night with in bed. But one of my Kauai friends is dead, and 2 of the 8 from Triangle Drive-In. Tonight, if I could crowd them all into the last of the Crow riprap, we drift by a mid-50s Buick, a Roadmaster, windowless but big enough for everyone. We lean back, listen to the river's somber tunes, and watch the big dark sky, our only screen, roll over us until the end tells us more than we need to know.
Wow. Well, that's great.
It's one of Don's written some great poems, and that's a good one. And this is his former student, Not Fishing the Drive-In, for Don Johnson by Robert Harlow. At first, you don't know what to make of it. All these cars lined up, trunks in the water, hoods rising to the big Montana sky, slightly submerged, chrome and rust, roofs battered in. Looks like a parking lot at the edge of the Bighorn River. Suddenly gave way, dropping the cars in sync to the water. When you learn it's a way to tame erosion of the banks caused by strong and damaging river, that's a common sight throughout the state. You know nothing apocalyptic happened here. No horror film about some car-crushing beast stomping over cars filled with screaming teenagers frozen in their vehicles as the howling creature makes its orderly way up the line. Locked doors and crushed out windshields showing them there is no refuge from what lurks outside when the cars can't be started. Now we are rode past the still old but mundane reality of once beautiful cars from the 40s, 50s, and early 60s to where we paid the guide to take us in two boats. Someone in our boat decides it's too much, like a graveyard, to remain, so we turn back. The other boat decides to stay and get what they paid for. Well, I think about all those lives that used to be, once proud owners of cars, never to be restored, brought back to life. Ghosts, someone whispers. We are all silent on the way back from not fishing the drive-in, as the guys call this place now. Who knew I could see myself sitting in the back seat of some of those same cars, looking out the windows, my father and mother up front. None of us dreaming automobiles could be used to try to fool nature into behaving so far out west. But it looks like rust is winning, and the riverbank still slipping under as we pass. So I just raised my hand slightly in salute to what almost was and for what used to be.
Wow.
What a nice two pairing of poems. This is one that I'm reading, and think of my brother-in-law, who often talks about having been, you know, my brother-in-law Ted's book about Vietnam I gave you, that about Shibe Park in the old days, and how Bob Costas, so many people, excuse me, have written about the first time you see the stadium, when you really see it, not on TV, you're there. It's titled The Stadium by Sidney Lee, L-E-A. The Yankees would play in the series. That's how it always ended. A breadbox-sized TV, black and white, of course, would stand on a desk in the lobby. Afternoon classes suspended. Students, secretaries, nurse, principal, and teachers all would follow the game. My athletics were out of contention again by July that season, and now it was early September. Ferris Fane, Gus Zerniel, Elmer Moonface Vallow, they and their teammates would soon be consigned to the almanacs, but that must have been beyond me. They were gods. And yet in the photo I took with my Kodak Brownie, they're featureless. Oh, amazing that I found that snapshot today. It's just as clear as back then that it didn't catch what lodged in my mind. The stadium. Some early leaves had fallen in the past night's rain, so littered the sidewalk outside the park. That signified nothing. Summer's mid-Atlantic mugginess remained, even as my father and I made our way to the right field stands through a grimy tunnel, cement flaking from ceiling and walls. I'd vehemently refused Dad's offer to hold my hand. No, baby, I was a boy, one who dreamed of hitting the blast that notched the pennant for the A's, and yet no dream could compare me for what that passage led to, a span of green so vast I knew it couldn't be part of any human design. The glory days of Simmons, Fox, and Cochran and Grove had been over for decades. No matter, that view would define the sublime for me, forever. My father would later chuckle with my mother at how the A's manager, my age, slept through most of the game, still, however, flashing inscrutable signs in slumber. My team of heroes, gone broke, would soon enough disappear. I'd go myself to college, and then out of state like my A's, and having no choice, I'd adopt another squad to cheer. So much would ensue. One day I'd stand at the Rijksmuseum, breathless before the night watch. I'd look out from Alpine peaks. I'd see Aida performed in Verona's Colosseum. But oh, 1952. Oh, Shibe Park, the stadium.
Mm. What was your first stadium?
Oh, Yankee Stadium, Old Timers Day, 1958. Saw Ted Williams and Mickey Mantle play in the game, and Yogi Berra, and saw all the great Yankees come out for the Old Timers Day game. But in those days, you could walk on the field and out through the center field. And that was the only time I did it. My grandfather said, I think you want to do this. And we did that, and it was really cool. Mm. I've never had anything cooler happen to me in a stadium. Which was your first one?
Fenway, 1968, against the Yankees. And Mantle was playing. Watched him hit a ground ball to short and half jog about five steps out of the batter's box, and then
it was over
to the dugout because he had nothing left.
No legs left. And here's an interesting one. This is by a poet named Jack Riddle, R-I-D-L. He's really good, and I haven't seen this poem before. Coach's son tells his wife what it was like. I couldn't wait for the game to be over. Win, lose, I knew what was next. Talk. Sports pages, television, radio, talk. Win was seldom good enough. Quote, I thought you'd take him by more than that. Why'd your old man keep Daniels in? He was terrible. Why the hell did he switch to a zone? Losing led to all the reasons I'd suck it up to hear. Your father sure blew it at the end. When's he going to give up on Granger at that position? Headline. Looks like a long losing year. Headline. This could be coach's last season. At school, I'd sit in class wishing I could read car dealer blows sale at end of day. Dentist screws up root canal. Sports writer gets score all wrong. After each game, I would lie in bed readying my words, cringe as I felt my hands fold into fists.
Wow.
Yeah, that one hits home. Now this is by someone named Gordon Kipola or Kipola, I don't know how, K-I-P-P-O-L-A. Move your feet on D, old man. This is great. The tower still stood the last time you shot hoops, but here's a bent orange rim, a ball, and six guys. You're stuck guarding this agile young giant. Your opponent's got 4 inches on you. Surmountable if you're quicker, stronger, and peak testosterone invulnerable. But being 45, you're none of those things. Play the kid tight, one fake, and he smokes you for layups. Retreat 2 steps, watch him nail jumpers you might have blocked when you still had springs. You admire his solid form, shoulder square to the basket, elbow straight, wrist flick, high arc, practice follow through, excuse me, while waving comically at lazy passes you slow motion sweat and stumble. He beat you like you beat your father once, when Pop was the same age you've become. Somehow, half a head shorter, softened belly, post-prime reflexes that gave him no chance to release clear shots while you could juke, elevate, light him up at will from 20, or butt push into unmissable two-footers. You blank on 1980 details, but after seeing his antique canvas high tops resting on a stack of old bank calendars left beside the curb for the trash man, you hope your dad, you hope you cut your dad some slack.
Yeah, happens to all of us.
Oh, yes, it does. Oh, yes, it does. And then a golf poem that is pretty deep in a lot of ways, called Rain Play by Dave Smith. Today, a man I play golf with stopped me to ask how it was going, and I thought how I'd endured his unbearable habit of hanging a portable radio on his bag, hole after hole of country music, most of us too weak to say we want some quiet. Enough gabble about so many abandoned, those cheating drunks and dreamers, hearts all but cut out of chests, words spinning and wobbling to a bad end, like balls we hit one after another. But won't suffering teach us to dream away failure, hurt, pain they sing so sweetly? So I said I was going okay, never better, as if it was true, making us nod together. I didn't ask about his son's cancer or his dead wife or when we'd play again. Like Hemingway, I walked off in the rain. You remember the novel's end? True, but unbelievable, like guitars and big hats. Like finding yourself in a pastel golf shirt, bizarrely striped, driving home, cleats on. I'll see you. Thinking about rain, mud, the hope you'll play tomorrow. Take care.
Wow. I like that.
Yeah, I like the two. That, and I had to, the first time I read through, I'd read it a second time out loud to make sure I was getting it. Another former guest of the show, Rick Burton, who, along with Norm O'Reilly, used to write the columns for the Sports Business Journal. This is called Night Race. That moment is frozen in time. Your dress and slip racing smoothly through curves like Mears Penske PC-10 at Riverside or Holbert and Bell's Porsche 962 at Miami. Watch them accelerate to the floor, moving through the chicane, gears shifted ever so fluidly. We both know without a doubt who is really in the driver's seat.
Mm.
That's the first sort of erotic car racing poem I've ever come across. Let's see. I wanted to get to some of Dale Rearbush's poems that are here a little later in the collection. I know I have them marked. Oh, this one first by Scott Hutchinson. Post-game show, nobody watches. After football's professional and dirty hits have stumbled back from spectacle, limped away through the tunnels, exiting towards locker rooms and parking lots, the cleaners in the stands start high, leaf blowers blasting human debris to the bottom for collection and disposal. A second crew deals with the seat, spill, sweat, and vomit, industrial spray and vac systems dispersing cleaning solution, dirt and bacteria pressure tackled, then sucked up, same for the godless restrooms. Down here on the field, our crew handles what has sifted and oozed and trickled its way to turf. Gatorade bottles with someone's dried and multicolored sputum, vestiges of athletic tape cut and torn from fingers, ankles, thigh pads, sleeves and makeshifts for fighting off impact burns on the rubberized surface, various Velcro straps, towels covered in perspiration and tears, sticky gloves, swapped out spikes, wires and zip ties mindlessly abandoned by hasty and invasive cameras. Handmade signs of love and support dropped aimlessly after the loss. Flotsam and the team-colored jetsam tumbled by the same breezes that play havoc with uprights, swatting back field goal attempts. Fiberglass warming benches strong enough to withstand the hard plop from butt tons of offensive linemen have become basins for small pools of blood stained in red smears along their red leg rub faces. Every game without fail. Men earn their money here today, but nobody wants to see the broken places up close. We are hired for spit shine. We hit it with top pressure. Still it fights us. We play hard, work into the night under spotlighted glare. By tomorrow, you can walk through and think this is a clean, sparkling arena for a good old boys' game. We do our job, but we think about the worry line wives, gathering up the aftermath of broken scabs, crusted and splitting scrapes, sutures sewn less than tight. They remove next day's bedsheets for washing or disposal. We wear nitrile gloves, mechanically keeping our distance. They hold remnants of what they love in their bare hands. Mm-hmm. I always wonder what it would be like to be the guy who cleans up the stadium. Just a couple of quick ones here. I want to get to the Dale Ritterbusch ones. Let me find out where they are because there were so many good poems here. 102. That's where I'm going to be. This is called Popping Up to Second. Dale is a really good poem. One of the most memorable things I remember is him reading in a wine cave in Limoges, France, when we were there in 2019, and saying to myself, you have to read after this guy? I had a little more wine. Popping up to second. A good eye isn't good enough when the pitch burns across the plate hotter than you've ever seen it before. But hitting is simply a matter of adjustment, as all things become simply matters of adjustment, the exchange of one value for another. One marriage, one house, one job, one school, easily exchanged with a simple shift from one stance or position to some other, often but a minor variant of the one before. So maybe this is the first lesson on a field packed hard and worn by children playing ball before the bell rings, playing again during recess and after school until it's time to go and play the game of family and homework. But one doesn't know any of this under a sun so bright. It burns past middle age, past demolition of the old school and the playground, now the site of a new one made of concrete block and a metal roof. Rather like a prison, the architecture of schools and prisons being one and the same. So this was a game that mattered, being in second place in the grade school league. And the pitcher, rumored to be faster than any we'd faced before, could seal up first with a win. So I dig in, concentrate, and swing hard at the next pitch right down the middle. But I'm too fast, ahead of the ball, as it lifts lazily into the sun, backing up the second baseman who puts it away for an easy out. When I die, I want all my adjustments so right at that time, at the time to come into play. I'll have the perfect wife, a perfect child, a car that never breaks down, a house that never needs any repair or restoration, and a job where people at the top actually like what I do. I'll hit a liner so hard the pitcher flattens on the mound and the ball will scream past the second baseman who won't even see it or hear it until it takes off his ear. And I'll waltz around second and just stand there in the diamond studious glare, adjusting my eyes to the sun, burning the world to perfection.
Very nice.
Okay, I'll finish this with this one.
Okay, sure.
Like good. This is another one by Dale, and I thought of you because it mentions history class. It's called What Nobody Learns. In history class, the athlete who letters in three sports dreams, even on game day of practice, of how energy contained in the classroom all day long explodes on the ball, a perfect afternoon when everything falls just right. His teacher knows what has happened, what will happen based on the past. That is the reason for studying, for knowing what has gone on before. It is predictability within a circumscribed time frame, a certainty that mastery of all that has gone on before will give to the present understanding a reluctance to repeat ancestral error. But the athlete, ignorant perhaps even of those who have played his game before, thinks only of the moment, of time, focused on one shot, one play, one well-timed hit. It is the arrest of history, the creation of the moment that makes history, which concerns him, unknowing as he is. And the teacher professes the past, the present arrested in the stale air of the classroom. The playing field awaits within limits of historical imagination. A ball slams into the gap. Mm.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Bruce.
Yeah, this is a really, really great issue of Athlon. AETHLON. You can look at Sport Lit Literature, find it on the web. You can subscribe. It's a great publication.